where they ran, the beasts. The wild boar, snuffling and grunting and rooting with his long tusks. The sow with the piglets bounding behind her, in and out of a copse. The shuttle raced in her hands, and she saw nothing, only the snorting snuffle of the swine in the forest. Ceridwen, goddess, mother, death crone, great raven, lady of death and life, great sow eater of your young, I call you, I summon you. If this is truly what you have decreed, it is for you to accomplish it. Time slid and shifted around her. She lay in the glade with the sun burning her back while she ran with the king stag. She moved through the forest softly, snuffling. She sensed the life, the hunters trampling and shouting, Mother, great sow. Morgaine knew in a random corner of her mind that her hands continued to move, steadily. Green and brown, brown and green. But beneath her lowered eyelids she saw nothing of the room or the threads, but only the new green springing beneath the trees, the mud and dead leaves brown from the winter, trampling. It was as if she rooted on all fours in the fragrant mud. Life of the mother there beneath the trees. Behind her the little gruntings and squealings of the piglets, tusks tearing up the ground for hidden roots and acorns, brown and green, green and brown. Like a shock to her nerves, as if it ripped through her body, she felt the sound of the trampling in the forest, the distant cries. Her body sat motionless before the loom, weaving brown threads and changing for green, shuttle after shuttle, only her fingers alive. But with the starting thrill of terror and rush of rage, she charged, letting the life of the swine rush through her. Goddess, let not the innocent suffer. The huntsmen are nothing to you. She could do nothing. She watched in dread, trembling, shuddering with the smell of blood, the smell of her mate's blood. Blood spilled from the great boar. But this was nothing to her. Like the king stag, he must die. When his time was come, then must his blood be shed on the earth. Behind her she heard the squeals of frenzied piglings, and suddenly the life of the great goddess rushed through her, not knowing whether she was Morgaine or the great sow, heard her own high, frenzied grunting, as when in Avalon she had raised her hands and brought down on her the mists of the goddess, so she flung her head back, shivering, grunting, hearing the terror of her piglings, making short little rushes, flinging up her head, rushing in circles. Green and brown under her eyes, an irrelevant shuttle in automatic fingers. Unnoticed. Then, maddened by the alien smells, blood, iron, strangeness, the enemy rising on two legs, steel and blood and death, she felt herself charge, heard cries, felt the hot stab of metal and red blurring her eyes through the brown and green of the forest, felt her tusks tearing, felt hot blood burst forth and gush as the life went out of her in searing pain, and she fell and knew no more. And the shuttle went on, leaden, weaving brown and green and brown over the agony in her belly, and the red bursting through her eyes and her pounding heart. The screams still in her ears in the silent room, where there was no sound, but the whisper of shuttle and warp and spindle and distaff. She swung silent in her trance, exhausted, slumped forward at the loom, and lay there motionless. After a time she heard Maylene speak, but she neither moved nor answered.
Oh, Gwyneth! Morag! Mother, are you ill?
Oh, heaven, she will weave, and always it brings these fits upon her. Owain, Accolon, come! Mother has fallen at her loom. She felt the woman restlessly chafing her hands, calling her name, heard Accolon's voice, felt him lift and carry her. She did not, could not, move or speak. She let them lay her on her bed, bring wine to revive her, felt it trickle down her neck, and wanted to say,
I am all right. Let be.
But she heard herself make a frightened little grunting sound and was still, agony ripping her, knowing that in death the great sow would release her, but first she must suffer the death throes. And even as she lay there, blind, tranced, agonized, she heard the hunting horn sound and knew that they were bringing Avaloch home, dead on his horse, slain by the sow which had attacked him within moments after he had killed the boar. And he in turn had slain the sow. Death and blood and rebirth, and the flow of life in and out of the forest, like the winding in and out of the shuttle. It was hours later. She still couldn't move a muscle without griping, terrifying pain. Almost she welcomed it. I should not go wholly free of this death, but Accolon's hands are clean. She looked up into his eyes. He was bending over her with concern and dread, and they were alone for a moment. "Are you able to speak now, my love?" he whispered. "What happened?" She shook her head and couldn't speak, but his hands on her were tender, welcome. "Do you know what I have done for you, dear love?" He bent and kissed her. He would never know how close they had come to being exposed and defeated. "I must go back to father," he said, gently, troubled. "He weeps and says, if I had gone, my brother wouldn't have died. He will blame me always." His dark eyes rested on her, a shadow of disquiet in them. "It was you who commanded me not to go," he said. "Did you know this with your magic, beloved?" She found a shred of voice through the soreness in her throat. "It was the will of the goddess," she said, "that Avaloch should not destroy what we have done here." She managed with great pain to move her finger, tracing out the line of the tattooed serpent on the hand that touched her face. His expression changed, grew suddenly fearful. "Morgaine, had you any part in this?" "Ah, I should have known how he would look at me if he knew." "Can you ask?" she whispered. "I was weaving in the hall all this day in clear sight of Maylene and the servants and the children." "It was her will and her doing, not mine."
"But you knew. You knew."
Slowly, her eyes filling with tears, she nodded, and he bent and kissed her lips.
"Be it so. It was the will of the goddess," he said, and he went away.
Chapter 3. There was a place in the woods where a rushing stream broadened out between rocks into a deep pool. Morgaine sat there on a flat rock, overlooking the water, and made Accolon sit beside her. They would be unseen here, except by the little ancient folk, and they would never betray their queen. "My dear, all these years we have worked together. Tell me, Accolon, what is it you think we are doing?"
"Lady, I have been content to know you had a purpose," he said, "and not to ask questions of you. If you had sought only for a lover..." He raised his eyes to her and reached for her hands. "There would have been others than I for that, better suited to such games. I love you well, Morgaine, and I have been glad and honoured that you turned to me, even for companionship and the touch of tenderness. But it wasn't that which called me to you, priest to priestess."
He hesitated, and sat stirring the sand at his feet with a booted foot. Finally he said,
"It has come to me, too, that there was more of a purpose in this than the wish of a priestess to restore the rites in this country, or your need to draw down upon us the moon tides. Glad I have been to aid you in this, and share the worship with you, lady. Lady of this land you have been indeed, especially to the ancient folk who see in you the face of the goddess. For a time, I thought it was only that we had been called to restore the old worship here. But now it comes to me, I know not why. He touched the serpents which twined about his wrists. That by these I am bound to this land, to suffer, and perhaps to die if need be. I have used him, Morgaine thought, as ruthlessly as ever Vivian did me. He said, I know it well. Not once in 100 years now is that old sacrifice exacted. Yet when these, again he touched with a brown fingertip the serpents encircling his wrist, were set here, it came to me that perhaps I should indeed be the one called by the lady for that ancient sacrifice. In the years between, I had come to think of this as no more than a green boy's fancy. But if I am to die... And his voice faded like the ripples in the dying pool. It was very still. They could hear some insect making a small dry noise in the grass. Morgaine spoke no word, though she could feel his fear. He must pass the barriers of fear unaided, even as had she, or Arthur, or the Merlin, or any other facing that last testing. And if he was to face the final test, he must go to it consenting. At last he asked, "Is it exacted of me, then, lady, that I must die? I had thought, if blood sacrifice is demanded, then when Avaloch fell prey to her..." And she saw the muscles in his face move. He tightened his jaw and swallowed hard. Still she said nothing, though her heart ached in pity. For some reason she heard Vivian's voice in her mind. "A time will come when you will hate me as much as you love me now." And felt again the surge of love and pain. Still she hardened her heart. Accolon was older than Arthur had been when he faced his king-making. And while Avaloch had indeed been blood sacrifice, spilled to the goddess, still another's blood could not redeem any other, nor could Avaloch's death free his brother of the obligation to face his own. At last his breath went out in a harsh sigh. "So be it. I have faced death in battle often enough. I swore unto her, even to death, and I shall not be forsworn. Tell me her will, lady." Then at last she stretched out her hand and clasped his. "I do not think it is death that will be demanded of you, and certainly not the altar of sacrifice. Still, testing is needed, and death lies always near to the doors of such testing. Would it reassure you to know that I too have faced death this way? Yet I am here at your side. Tell me, are you sworn, man to man, to Arthur?" "I'm not one of his companions," Accolon said. "Owain you have seen sworn to him, but not I, though I have fought willingly enough among his men." Morgaine was glad, though she knew that she would even have used the oath of a companion against Arthur now. "Listen to me, my dear," she said. "Arthur has twice betrayed Avalon, and only from Avalon can a king reign over all this land. I have sought again and again to call to Arthur's mind that oath he gave, but he will not hear me, and he holds still in his pride the holy sword Excalibur, the sword of the sacred regalia, and with it the magical scabbard I fashioned for him." She saw his face turn pale. "You mean it truly, that you will bring Arthur down?" "Not so. Not unless he refuses still to bring his oath to completion," Morgaine said. "I shall give him still every opportunity to become what he has sworn to be. And Arthur's son is not yet ripe to the challenge. You are no boy, Accolon, and you are trained to kingcraft, not druidcraft, in spite of these." And she laid a slender fingertip on the serpents encircling his wrist. "Say then, Accolon of Wales, if all other shifts fail, will you be champion of Avalon and challenge the betrayer for that sword he holds by betrayal?" Accolon drew a long breath. "To challenge Arthur?" "Fitly did you ask, Morgaine, if I am ready to die," he said. "And you speak to me in riddles. I knew not that Arthur had a son." "His son is son to Avalon and to the spring fires," said Morgaine. She thought she had long outgrown shame for this. "I am priestess. I need make no accounting to any man for what I must do." But she couldn't force herself to meet Accolon's eyes. "Listen, and I will tell you all." He sat silent as she told him of the king-making on Dragon Island, and what had befallen after. But when she told how she had fled from Avalon, and of Gwydion's birth, he put out his hand and encircled her small fingers in his own. "He has passed his own testing," said Morgaine, "but he is young and untried. None thought that Arthur would betray his oath." "Arthur was young, too, but he came to his king-making when Uther was old and dying, and men were seeking everywhere for a king of the Avalon line. Now Arthur's star is high, and his renown great, and even with all the powers of Avalon at his back, Gwydion could never challenge Arthur for his throne." "How is it that you think I can challenge Arthur and get the sword Excalibur from him, and not be slain at once by his men?" said Accolon. "There is nowhere in this world that I can challenge him where he goes not so guarded." "That is true," Morgaine said, "but you needn't challenge him in this world. There are other realms which are not within this world at all, and within one of these realms you may get from him the sword Excalibur, to which he has forfeited all shadow of right, and the magical scabbard which protects him from all harm. Once disarmed, he is no more than any other man. I have seen his companions, Lancelot, Gawain, Gareth, disarm him in play in their mock battles. Without his sword, Arthur is easy prey. He is not the greatest of warriors, nor with that sword and scabbard did he ever need to be. And Arthur, once dead..." She had to stop and steady her voice, knowing she incurred the curse of Kinslayer, that same curse she had hesitated to bring on Accolon when Avaloch died. "Arthur, once dead," she repeated firmly at last, "I am nearest his throne and his sister. I shall rule as Lady of Avalon, and you as my consort and Duke of War. True, in your time you too will be challenged and brought down as King Stag. But before that day comes, you shall have your day as king at my side." Accolon sighed. "I never thought to be king. But if you bid me, lady, I must do her will, and yours. Yet to challenge Arthur for his sword..." "I did not mean that you shall do so without all the help I can give. For what else have I been schooled all these weary years in magic? And for what have I made you my priest? And there is one greater than I who shall help us both to your testing." "Speak you of those magical realms?" Accolon asked her, almost in a whisper. "I do not understand you." "That surprises me not. I know not myself what I mean to do, nor what I say," Morgaine thought, but she recognized the strange dimness rising in her mind, clouding thoughts, as that state in which powerful magic was made. "I must trust to the goddess now, and let her lead me. Not I alone, but he who stands at my side, who will take up the sword from Arthur's hand. Trust me, and obey."
She rose, moving through the woods on silent feet, looking for... What was she looking for? She asked, and heard her voice, distant and strange. "Does hazelwood grow within this forest, Accolon?" He nodded, and she followed him to the grove of trees, at this season just bursting into leaf and flower. The wild pigs who roamed here had eaten the last of the nuts. Fragments of nut hulls lay scattered on the thick leaf mould of the forest floors. Yet new shoots were springing, too, toward the light, where new trees would rise, so that the life of the forest would never die. Flower and fruits and seed, and all things return and grow and come to light, and at the last give up their bodies into the keeping of the lady again. But she who works, silently and alone, at the heart of nature, cannot work her magic without the strength of him who runs with the deer and with the summer sun draws forth the richness of her womb. Beneath the hazel tree she looked across at Accolon, and while part of her mind was aware that this man was her lover, her chosen priest, she knew that now he had consented to a testing beyond what she alone could confer. Before ever the Romans had come to these hills, seeking for tin and lead, the hazel grove had been a sacred place. At the edge of the grove there was a pool, standing beneath three of the sacred trees, hazel and willow and alder, a magic older than the magic of the oak. The surface of the pool was somewhat obscured with dry sticks and leaves, but the water was clear and dark, brown with the clear brown of the forest, and she saw her own face reflected as she bent and dipped up the water in her hand, touching it to brow and lips. Before her eyes, the reflected face shifted and changed, and she saw the strange deep eyes of the woman from that older world than this. And something in her crawled in terror at what she saw in those eyes. The world had shifted subtly round them. She had believed this strange, ancient land lay at the borders of Avalon, not here in the remote fastnesses of North Wales. Yet, a voice said silently in her mind, I am everywhere, and where the hazel reflects in the sacred pool, there am I. She heard Accolon draw in a breath of wonder and awe, and turned to see that the lady of the fairy kingdom was with them, standing straight and silent in her shimmering garment, the crown of bare wicker withies above her brow. Was it she who spoke, or the lady? There is other testing than the running of the deer. And suddenly it was as if a horn rang out far and eerie through the hazel grove. Or was it the hazel grove? And then the leaves lifted and stirred, and there was the rushing of sudden winds, making the branches creak and sway, and a chill of fear rippled through Morgaine's body and blood. He is coming. Slowly, reluctant, she turned, and saw that they weren't alone in the grove. There, at the edge between the worlds, he was standing. Never did she ask Accolon what it was that he saw. She saw only the shadow of the antler crown, the bright leaves of gold and crimson, where they stood in a wood gilded with the first buds of spring, the dark eyes. Once she had lain with him on a forest floor like this, but he hadn't come for her this time, and she knew it. Now she, and even the lady, must step aside. His step, light on the leaves, still somehow raised the wind that kept thrusting floods of air through the grove, so that her hair blew about on her forehead, and she felt her cloak flapping with it. He was tall and dark, and he seemed at once to be clothed in the richest garments, and in leaves. And at the same time she would have taken oath that his flesh gleamed smooth and naked before them. He gestured, raising one slender hand, and as if compelled, Accolon moved slowly forward, step by step. And at the same time it was Accolon that she could see crowned and robed with leaves and antlers,
glimmering in the strange motionless light of fairy. Morgaine felt herself buffeted, struck and battered by the wind. In the grove, she knew, were forms and faces she couldn't clearly see. This testing wasn't for her, but for the man at her side. It seemed that there were cries and horn calls. Were there riders within the air, or did the beating of their hooves drum on the forest floor with this great noise that drowned out thought? She knew Accolon was no longer at her side. She stood clasping the bark of the hazel tree, her face hidden. She didn't know. She would never know. It was not for her to know what form Accolon's king-making should take. That wasn't in her power to give, or to know. She had invoked the powers of the Horned One through the lady, and he had gone where she couldn't follow. She never knew how long she stood there, clutching at the hazel bark, her brow pressed painfully against the bole of the tree. And then the wind died, and Accolon was with her. They stood together, alone in the hazel grove, hearing only the beat of thunder from a dark and cloudless sky where the sun's rim glared like hot metal behind the moon's dark eclipse disk, and the stars burned against the unfallen night. Accolon's arm was around her. He whispered, "What is it? What is it?" "It is the eclipse." Her voice was steadier than she could have believed. She felt her heart beat quieting to normal at the touch of his arms, warm and alive, holding her. The ground was quite steady under her feet again, the solid earth of the hazel grove. And when she looked down into the pool, she saw fragments of broken boughs from the uncanny wind that had ravaged the grove. Somewhere a bird complained at the sudden dark, and at their feet a small pink piglet rooted in the dead leaf mould. Then the light began to steal so brightly that she saw the shadow passing away from the sun. She saw Accolon staring at the brightness and said sharply, "Turn away your eyes. You can be blinded now the darkness is gone." He swallowed and lowered his face to hers. His hair was awry with a wind that wasn't of this world, and clinging to his hair was a crimson leaf, which made Morgaine shiver as they stood beneath the just unfolding buds of the hazel. He said in a whisper, "He is gone. And she. Or was it you, Morgaine? Did it happen? Was any of it real?" Morgaine, looking into his dazzled face, saw something in his eyes, something that had never been there before, the touch of the non-human. She reached out and plucked the crimson leaf from his hair, holding it out to him. "You, who bear the serpents, need you question?" "Ah!" She saw the shudder run right through him. He struck the crimson leaf from her hand with a savage gesture, letting it fall silent to the forest floor, and said, with a gasp, "It seemed that I rode high above the world, and saw such things as come never to mortal man." And then he reached for her with blind urgency, tearing at her dress and pulling her down to the ground. She let him do as he would, and lay stunned on the damp ground as he thrust blindly into her, driven by a force he hardly understood. It seemed to her, as she lay silent beneath that driving strength, that his face was shadowed again with antlers, or with crimson leaves. She had no part in this. She was only the passive earth beneath rain and wind, thunder and lightning bolt. And it was as if the lightning struck through her into the earth beneath. Then the darkness receded, and the strange stars shining forth by day were all gone, and Accolon's hands, tender and apologetic, were helping her to rise, to arrange her disordered dress. He bent to kiss her, to stammer some half-explanation, some word of excuse. But she smiled and laid her hand across his lips. "No, no, it is enough."
The grove was silent again, and around them were only the normal sounds of the quiet day. She said calmly,
"We must go back, my love. We will be missed, and everyone will be shouting and crying out about the eclipse, as if it was some strange marvel of nature," and smiled faintly. She had seen something far stranger than an eclipse this day.
Accolon's hand was cold and solid in hers. He whispered as they walked,
"I never knew that you look like her, Morgaine. But I am she."
However, Morgaine didn't speak the words aloud. He was an initiate. He should have been better prepared, perhaps, for this testing. Yet he had faced it as he must, and he had been accepted by something beyond her own small powers. Then cold struck at her heart, and she turned to look at his smiling, beloved face. He had been accepted, but that didn't mean he would triumph. It meant only that he might attempt the final testing for which this was only the beginning.
"I felt not like this when a spring maiden I sent Arthur, whom I knew not to be Arthur, forth for his testing. Ah, goddess, how young I was then, how young we both were, mercifully young, for we knew not what we did. And now I am old enough to know what it is that I do. How shall I have courage to send him forth to face death?"
Chapter 4.
On the eve of Pentecost, Arthur and his queen had bidden those guests with family ties to the throne to dine with them privately. Tomorrow would be the usual great banquet for all of Arthur's subject kings and his companions. But Guinevere, dressing herself carefully, felt that this would be the greater ordeal. She had long accepted the inevitable. Her husband and lord would, by his act tomorrow, make public and irrevocable what had long been known. Tomorrow Galahad would be made knight and companion of the Round Table. Oh, she had known it for years, yes. But then Galahad had been only a fair-haired little boy growing up somewhere in King Pellinore's lands. When she had thought of it, she'd even been pleased. Lancelot's son, by her own cousin Elaine, now dead in childbed, was reasonable heir for the king. But now she felt him a living reproach to an ageing queen whose life had been without fruit. "You are distressed," said Arthur, watching her face as she set the coronet about her hair. "I'm sorry, Guinevere. I thought it would be the way to get to know the lad, as I must if he is to have my throne. Shall I tell him that you are ill? You need not appear. You can meet him at some other time."
Guinevere tightened her mouth.
"As well now as later?"
He took her hand.
"I do not see Lancelot very often any more. It will be good to speak with him again."
Her mouth moved in something she knew wasn't the smile she had intended.
"I wonder you will have it so. Do you not hate him?"
Arthur smiled uneasily.
"We were all so much younger then. It seems as if it was all in another world, and Lance no more than my dearest and oldest friend, almost my brother, as much as Kai."
"Kai is your brother, too," said Guinevere, "and his son Arthur is one of your most loyal knights.
It seems to me that he would make a better heir than Galahad." "Young Arthur is a good man and a trusty companion, but Kai's blood isn't royal. God knows, in all these years I've wished often enough that Ectorius had in truth been my own father. But he was not, and there's an end of it, Gwen."
After a moment, hesitant, he had never spoken of this, not since that other dreadful Pentecost, he said,
"I have heard that the other lad, Morgaine's son, is in Avalon."
Guinevere put out a hand as if to avoid a blow.
"No."
"I will arrange it so that you need never meet him," he said, But royal blood is royal blood, and something must be done for him. He cannot have my throne. The priests wouldn't have it.
Oh, said Guinevere. And if the priests would have it, I suppose you would proclaim Morgaine's son your heir.
There will be those who wonder that he is not, said Arthur. Would you have me try to explain it to them?
Then you should keep him far from the court, said Guinevere, thinking, I didn't know my voice was so harsh when I was angry. What place at this court has one who has been reared in Avalon as a druid?
He said dryly, The Merlin of Britain is one of my counsellors, and has always been so, Gwen. Those who look to Avalon are always my subjects, too. It is written, Other sheep have I, which are not of this fold.
A blasphemous jest, Guinevere observed, making her voice gentler, and hardly suitable for the eve of Pentecost.
Arthur said, Before Pentecost there was always Midsummer, my love. At least now there are no Midsummer fires lighted, not even on Dragon Island, or, so far as I know, anywhere within 3 days' ride of Camelot, except on Avalon itself.
The priests have set wards on Glastonbury Island, I'm sure, said Guinevere, so that there shall be no coming and going from that land.
It would be a sad day if it should be lost forever, Arthur said, as it is sad for the peasant folk to lose their own festivals. Town folk perhaps have no need of the old rites. Oh, yes, I know there is only one name under heaven by which we may be saved. But perhaps those who live in such close kinship with the earth need something more than salvation. Guinevere started to speak, then held her peace. Kevin was no more than a misshapen old cripple and a druid, and the day of the druids now seemed to her as far away as the time of the Romans. And even Kevin was less known at court as the Merlin of Britain than as a superb harper. The priests didn't hold him in reverence as a good and kindly man, as once with Taliesin. Kevin's tongue was quick and ungentle in debate. Yet Kevin's knowledge of all the old ways and the common law was greater even than Arthur's, and Arthur had come into the way of turning to him when it was a question of old law and custom which couldn't be set aside.
"If this were not so strictly a family party, I would command that the Merlin perform for us tonight."
Arthur smiled and said, "I can send to ask of him, if you will. But such music as his is not to be commanded, even by a king. I can bid him dine at our table and beg him to honour us with a song."
She smiled back and said, "So the king begs of a subject, rather than the other way around?"
"There must be balance in all things," he said. "It is one of the things I have learned in my rule. In some matters a king cannot command, but must sue." Perhaps that was why the Caesars fell, because they fell into what my tutor used to call hubris, thinking they could command outside the legitimate sphere of a king. Well, my lady, our guests are waiting. Are you sufficiently beautiful?
She said, "You're making fun of me again. You know how old I am."
"You are scarcely older than I," said Arthur, "and my chamberlain tells me I am a handsome man still."
"Oh, but that is different. Men do not age as women do."
She looked at his face, which was only faintly lined with the years. A man in the prime of his life. He said, taking her hand,
"It would little beseem me to have a maiden at my side for my queen."
"You are suited to me."
They moved toward the door. The chamberlain approached and spoke in a low voice, and Arthur turned to Guinevere.
"There will be other guests at our table. Gawain sent word that his mother has come, and so we cannot but invite Lamorak as well, since he is her consort and travelling companion," said Arthur. "I haven't seen Morgause in many years, God knows, but she is my kinswoman too, and King Urien's and Morgaine with their sons.
Then it will be a family party indeed.
Yes, with Gareth and Gawain. Gaheris is in Cornwall, and Agravain couldn't leave Lothian, said Arthur.
And Guinevere felt pricked with an old grievance. Lot of Lothian had so many sons.
Well, my dear, our guests are assembled in the little hall. Shall we go down to them?
The great hall of the Round Table was Arthur's domain, a man's place where warriors and kings met. But the little hall, with the hanging she had ordered from Gaul, and the trestle tables and benches, that was where Guinevere felt most a queen. She was growing daily more short-sighted. At first, though there was still plenty of light, she saw only stripes of colour from the ladies' gowns and the brilliant indoor robes worn by the men. That huge figure there, well over 6 feet with a great shock of sandy hair, that was Gawain. He came to bow before the king, and then, rising, to embrace his cousin in a great bear hug. Gareth followed him more modestly, and Kai came to clap Gareth on the shoulder, to call him handsome in the old way, and to ask after his brood of children, still too young to come to court. The Lady Leonore's was, he said, still abed after their latest, and had stayed in their castle northward by the Roman war. Was that 8 now, or 9? Guinevere had seen the Lady Leonore's only twice, because always, according to Gareth, she was breeding or lying in or still suckling her latest. Gareth was no longer pretty-faced, but good-looking as ever, and as Arthur and Gawain and Gareth grew older, the resemblance between them all grew ever stronger. Now Gareth was being embraced by a slender man with dark curling hair streaked with grey. And Guinevere bit her lip. Lancelot changed not at all with the years, save to grow yet more handsome.
Urien's had none of that magical immunity to time. He looked at last really old, though he was still upright and strong. His hair was all white, and she heard him explaining to Arthur that he had but recently recovered from the lung fever, and had that spring buried his oldest son, savaged by a wild pig. Arthur said, "So you'll be King of North Wales one day, Sir Accolon. Well, so it shall be. God giveth and taketh, so it says in Holy Writ."
Urien's would have bent to kiss Guinevere's hand, but she leaned instead to kiss the old man on the cheek. He was foppishly dressed in green, with a handsome cloak of green and brown.
"Our queen grows ever younger," he said, smiling with good humour. "One would think you had dwelled in the fairy country, kinswoman."
Guinevere laughed. "Perhaps I should paint lines in my face, then, lest the bishops and priests think I have learned spells unseemly for a Christian woman. But such jesting is uncanny on the eve of a holy day. Well, Morgaine," for once she could greet her sister-in-law with a jest, "you seem younger than I, and I know you are older. What is your magic?"
"No magic," said Morgaine in her rich, low voice. "It is only that there is so little to occupy my mind, in that country at the end of the world, that it seems to me that time doesn't pass there, and so, perhaps, that is why I grow no older."
Now she looked closer. Guinevere could indeed see the small traces of time in Morgaine's face. Her skin was still smooth and unmarred, but there were tiny creases around her eyes, and the eyelids drooped a little. The hand she gave Guinevere was thin and bony, so that her rings hung loose. Guinevere thought, "Morgaine is at least 5 years older than I." And suddenly it seemed to her that they weren't women in middle life, but those two young girls who had met in Avalon. Lancelot had come first to greet Morgaine. Guinevere wouldn't have believed that she could still be torn with this raging passion of jealousy. "Now Elaine is gone, and Morgaine's husband is so old he surely cannot look to see another Christmas." She heard Lancelot speak some laughing compliment, heard Morgaine's low, sweet laughter.
But she doesn't look at Lancelot like a lover. Her eyes turn to Prince Accolon. He is a goodly man, too. Well, her husband is more than twice her age. And Guinevere felt a stab of self-righteous disapproval. "We should go to table," she said, beckoning to Kai. "Galahad must go at midnight to watch by his arms, and perhaps, like many young men, he would like to rest a little beforehand so he will not be sleepy."
"I shall not be sleepy, lady,"
the young man said, and Guinevere felt again the pain. She would so gladly have had this fair young man as her son.
He was tall now, broad-shouldered, and big as Lancelot had never been. His face seemed to shine with scrubbing and with a calm happiness. "This is all so new to me. Camelot is such a beautiful city. I can hardly believe it is real. And I rode here with my father. All my life my mother spoke of him as if he were a king or a saint quite beyond mortal men."
Morgaine said, "Oh, Lancelot is mortal enough, Galahad, and if you come to know him well enough, you will know it too." Galahad bowed politely to Morgaine. He said,
"I remember you. You came and took Nimue from us, and my mother wept. Is my sister well, lady?"
"I haven't seen her for some years," Morgaine said, "but if it was not well with her, I would have heard.
I remember only that I was angry with you for telling me that I was wrong about everything. You seemed very certain, and my mother..."
"No doubt your mother told you I am an evil sorceress."
She smiled.
"Smug as a cat,"
Guinevere thought, at the transparent blush that covered Galahad's face.
"Well, Galahad, you are not the first to think me so."
She smiled to Accolon, too, who returned the smile so openly that Guinevere was shocked. Galahad said bluntly,
"And are you a sorceress then, lady?"
"Well," said Morgaine with that cat-claw smile again, "no doubt your mother had reason to think me so.
Since now she is gone,
I may tell you all."
"Lancelot? Did Elaine never tell you how she begged and besought me for a charm that would turn your eyes on her?"
Lancelot turned to Morgaine, and it seemed to Guinevere that his face was stricken, tight with pain.
"Why make jests about days that are long gone, kinswoman?"
"Oh, but I jest not,"
said Morgaine, and for a moment she raised her eyes to meet Guinevere's.
"I thought it time you stopped breaking hearts all through the kingdoms of Britain and Gaul. So I made that marriage, and I do not regret it, for now you have a fine son who is heir to my brother's kingdom. If I hadn't meddled, you would have remained unwed, and still be breaking all our hearts. Would he not, Gwen?" she added audaciously.
"I knew it, but I didn't know Morgaine would confess it so openly." But Guinevere took a queen's privilege to change the subject.
"How does my namesake, your little Guinevere?"
"She is pledged in marriage to Lionel's son," Lancelot said, "and will be queen of Less Britain one day. The priest said the kinship was over close, but a dispensation could be had. I paid a great fee to the church for that to be set aside, and Lionel paid one too. The girl is but 9. And the wedding will not be for 6 years. "And your elder daughter?" asked Arthur.
"Sire, she is in a nunnery," Lancelot said.
"Is that what Elaine told you?" Morgaine asked, and again there was the flash of malice in her eyes.
"She is in your own mother's place in Avalon, Lancelot. Did you not know?"
He said peacefully,
"It is all one. The priestesses of the House of Maidens are much like to the nuns of Holy Church, living lives of chastity and prayer, and serving God in their own way."
He turned quickly to Queen Morgause, who was approaching them.
"Well, aunt, I cannot say you are unchanged by time, but the years have treated you kindly indeed."
"She looks so like Igraine. I have heard only the jests and have laughed at her. But now I can well believe that young Lamorack is beglamoured by her for love and not ambition."
Morgause was a big woman and tall. Her hair was still rich and red, flowing in loose braids over her green gown, a vast expanse of brocaded silk embroidered with pearls and golden threads. A narrow coronet set with shining topaz twinkled in her hair. Guinevere held out her arms and embraced her kinswoman, saying,
"You look much like Igraine, Queen Morgause.
I loved her well, and still I think often of her."
"When I was younger, that statement would have had me frantic with jealousy, Guinevere. I was maddened that my sister Igraine was more beautiful than I, and had so many kings and lords at her feet. Now I remember only that she was beautiful and kind, and I'm glad to know I resemble her still."
She turned to embrace Morgaine, and Guinevere saw that Morgaine was lost in the bigger woman's embrace, that Morgause towered over her.
"Why did I ever fear Morgaine? She is just a little thing, after all, and the queen of an unregarded kingdom."
Morgaine's dress was a simple dark wool, and she wore no ornament but a silver torque about her throat, and some kind of silver bracelet about her arms. Her hair, dark and rich as ever, was simply braided and wound around her head. Arthur had come up to embrace his sister and his aunt. Guinevere took Galahad's hand in hers.
"You shall sit by me, kinsman."
Ah, yes, this was the son I should have borne to Lancelot, or to Arthur.
She said, as they sat down,
"And now you have come to know your father, have you discovered, as Morgaine said, that he is no saint, but merely a very lovable man?"
"Ah, but what else is a saint?" asked Galahad, his eyes shining. "I cannot think of him as only a man, lady. He is surely more than that. He is the son of a king, too. And I am sure that if they chose the best rather than the eldest son, he would reign in less Britain."
"I think that man is happy whose father is also his hero," he said. "I have had some time to speak with Gawain. He despised his father and thought little of him. But no man has ever spoken of my father save with admiration."
"I hope, then, that you see him always as a hero untarnished," said Guinevere.
She had placed Galahad between herself and Arthur, as befitted the adopted heir to the kingdom. Arthur had chosen to seat Queen Morgause next to him, with Gawain beyond, and next to him Uwain, who was Gawain's friend and protégé, as Gareth had been Lancelot's when they were younger. At the table next to them were Morgaine and her husband, and other guests. They were all kin, but she couldn't see their faces clearly. She craned her neck and squinted to see, reproving herself. Squinting would make her ugly, and rubbed at the tight wrinkle beneath her brows. She wondered suddenly whereby her old fear of open spaces when she was a girl had simply come from being so short-sighted. Had she feared what the world was like only because she couldn't really see? She asked Arthur across Galahad, who was eating with the hearty appetite of a healthy boy still growing,
"Did you bid Kevin dine with us?"
"Aye, but he sent a message that he couldn't come. Since he could not be in Avalon, perhaps he keeps the holy day in his own fashion." "I bid Bishop Patricius as well, but he keeps the vigil of Pentecost in the church. He will see you there at midnight, Galahad."
"I think that being made a king must be a little like being made a priest," said Galahad clearly.
There was a lull in the conversation that made his young voice audible from one end of the table to another.
"They are both sworn to serve man and God, and to do what is right."
"Gareth said..."
I felt something like that, lad. God grant you see it always so. I have always wanted my companions to be men dedicated to the right, said Arthur. I do not demand that they be godly men, Galahad, but I have hoped they would be good men.
Lancelot said to Arthur,
Perhaps these youngsters may live in a world where it is easier to be good.
And it seemed to Guinevere that he sounded sad.
But you are good, father, said Galahad. All up and down this land it is told that you are King Arthur's greatest knight.
Lancelot chuckled, embarrassed.
Aye, like that Saxon hero who tore the arm from the lake monster. My works and deeds have been made into song, because the true tale isn't exciting enough to tell by the fireside in winter. But you did slay a dragon, did you not?
Galahad said.
Oh, yes. And it was a fearful beast enough, I suppose. But your grandsire did as much as I in killing it, said Lancelot. Guinevere, my lady, we dine never so well as at your table. Too well, said Arthur, cheerfully patting his middle. If feasts like this came often, I would be as fat as one of those beer-guzzling Saxon kings. And tomorrow is Pentecost, and another feast for even more folk. I do not know how my lady does it.
Guinevere felt a small glow of pride.
This feast is mine. That of tomorrow is Sir Kai's pride. For that one the beeves are already roasting in their pit. My lord Uriens, you are eating no meat.
Uriens shook his head.
A wing of one of those birds, perhaps? Since my son was slain, I have vowed never again to eat the flesh of swine. And your queen shares your vow, said Arthur. As always, Morgaine is all but fasting. No wonder you are so small and spare, my sister.
It is no hardship for me not to eat swine's flesh.
Is your voice sweet as ever, my sister? Since Kevin couldn't join us, perhaps you would sing or play.
If you had told me you wished it, I wouldn't have eaten so well. I cannot sing now. Later, perhaps.
Then you, Lancelot, Arthur said.
Lancelot shrugged and gestured to a servant to bring the harp.
Kevin will sing this tomorrow. I'm no match for him. I made the words from a Saxon poet. I said once I could live with the Saxons, but not with what they called music. Then, when I dwelt among them last year, I heard this song and wept when I heard it, and tried in my poor way to put it into our tongue.
He left his seat to take the small harp.
It is for you, my king, he said, for it speaks of what sorrow I knew when I dwelt far from court and from my lord. But the music is Saxon. I had thought before this that all their songs were of war and battle and fighting.
He began to play a soft, sorrowful melody. His fingers were not as skilful as those of Kevin, but the sad song had a power of its own, which gradually quieted them. He sang in the husky voice of an untrained singer.
What sorrow is like to the sorrow of one who is alone? Once I dwelt in the company of the king I loved well, and my arm was heavy with the weight of the rings he gave, and my heart weighed down with the gold of his love. The face of the king is like the sun to those who surround him. But now my heart is empty, and I wander alone throughout the world. The groves take on their blossoms, the trees and meadows grow fair. But the cuckoo, saddest of singers, cries forth the lonely sorrow of the exile. And now my heart goes wandering in search of what I shall never see more. All faces are alike to me if I cannot see the face of my king, and all countries are alike to me when I cannot see the fair fields and meadows of my home. So I shall arise and follow my heart in its wandering, for what is the fair meadow of home to me when I cannot see the face of my king? And the weight on my arm is but a band of gold when the heart is empty of the weight of love. And so I shall go roaming over the Fish's Road, and the Road of the Great Whale, and beyond the country of the wave, with none to bear me company, but the memory of those I loved, and the songs I sang out of a full heart.